You're listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Only here, lastwordonsports.com.
What's up, Internet? My name is Matt Pollard, and you are listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Only here, Last Word on Sports, lastwordonsoccer.com, powered by Last Word on Sports Incorporated, the Beautiful Game Network, and Roughneck Scarves. I'm joined now by my friend Daniel Sperry. Dan, how you doing? And according to Twitter, the Argentine Football Federation will be folding later today in the aftermath of Argentina's 3-0 loss to Croatia. How do you feel about that?
That is a complete shock. The performance that Argentina has put in has completely blown my mind. From especially today's standpoint, Croatia so far have been really impressive in both of their games, but at the same time, like, you would have thought Argentina would have put up a bit of a fight. Their third goal was pretty damning in the effort on their defensive side, to take care of the play. So kind of damning of their own and current situation. I saw a great tweet that kind of encapsulates what I've been feeling about them. And the question was, is Jurgen Klinsmann actually coaching this team right now? Because there are four center backs and one actual midfielder on the field at the moment, and that's not going to work. So I'm entirely shocked by Argentina in this World Cup. I'm disappointed that Peru is out. They've played some of the best soccer in this entire tournament. They just haven't been able to score a goal. They've lost both their games now to Denmark and France. So that's a little World Cup frustration on my part, but, you know, it sucks, but, you know, at least they've been incredibly entertaining and played really well in both their games, just haven't been able to put the ball in the back of the net.
I agree with you, Dan. I was catching up on the Planet Football podcast that Grant Wall from SI and Fox Sports has been doing, and he and Stephen Goff have turned it into a daily podcast for the entirety of the World Cup. They had Landon Donovan on earlier, and he was addressing some of the issues with his little snuff up over the weekend with him supporting El Tri via Wells Fargo. And he commented on, after they moved on from that topic, on how the soccer world has really gotten a lot smaller, and some of these nations that normally you wouldn't think anything of, or you wouldn't say would be very good, or you can't name any players on their team, have had some really, really good moments. You know, Nigeria has a number of very, very young, talented players that have gotten experience on the European continent. I don't think they're getting out of the group, but they're not the prototypical African team where you say that, oh, they're just going to sit deep, they're going to counter, and it's going to be all athleticism and speed and no real tactical acumen that you have. I've been impressed with Peru, as you said. Obviously, well, we don't need to document or say anything about what Iceland's done. They've certainly been tremendous what they've been in the last World Cup cycle, you know, going off of what they've done in 2016. So the soccer world's gotten a lot smaller. There are a lot of teams that have gotten a lot better. And in that sense, I'm trying to turn this into an argument to where I don't feel so bad about the United States, you know, not making the World Cup, so to speak. Are there any other big World Cup topics we really want to talk about, Dana? I was mentioning listeners right before we hit the record button. I don't want to talk too much about it, you know, because, you know, I don't want to rub salt in the wound to any of the Americans or Canadians who are listening to this, but at the same time, this is a soccer podcast, and the world's biggest soccer event of 4 years, you know, is taking place right now. So, I mean, at least on the MLS side, Dan, I've been a little bit disappointed. You know, Carlos Vela was okay against Germany. Obviously, our listeners know where we both stand as far as the Dos Santi brothers, but, you know, a lot of the, you know, the MLS performances, I think, have been what you've been expected and been decent, all things considered, from Panama. But I think the reality is setting in that Panama was having such a party when they qualified, because the reality is that, you know, I think they're about to get hit with a train over the course of the next week. Dan, your general thoughts on other World Cup happenings, and in particular your thoughts on the those in the MLS circles that are taking part over there in Russia.
Two other teams I'm going to point out that I've been impressed with what they've been doing so far. One, obviously, Mexico. That was a really, really good performance that they put in against Germany. I don't know if it was Germany wasn't up for it, then was kind of got smacked in the mouth and then didn't really react very well, or they just really got that far outplayed. Mexico's effort, their athleticism, they did everything right. Tactically, they were set up correct. They made a lot of good decisions throughout the whole match. The goal was fantastic. Mexico has been incredibly impressive for me. I didn't think they'd beat Germany. I thought they'd at least get out of their group, but the defeat of Germany is probably the biggest shock in the World Cup at the moment. So I'm impressed with them. Russia is weirdly good to watch, but I mean, they played Saudi Arabia and who else? Morocco?
Oh, it was Egypt.
No, who was it? Egypt. Yeah, I just don't. I don't buy it. They're going to get out of the knockout stage and they're going to face someone really freaking good and they're going to get punched in the mouth because in reality, they are the lowest ranked team in the World Cup. And they hadn't won a game in 8 months before they won their World Cup opener. So, it helps when you play, bad teams and teams that aren't well coached or well put together. That might have good players like Egypt do, but don't have all the stars aligned in the way that a team with stars and with good players should. Russia's been good. They've been entertaining, but it's been two games against pretty bad opponents. So let's hold off on the Russian praise until maybe they do something in the round of 16 or if they beat Uruguay in their final group match. But you know, there's a lot of teams in this that are impressive. Overall, Senegal is one. I won't go on and on and on, but Senegal was impressive. I did like what I saw from England. Tunisia was put up a heck of a fight against England, and I think it's going to be hard. That's going to be a rough one for Panama when they have to play that one to kind of finish off the World Cup I'm not sure if they do it now. Or if is the England Belgium game next, or is that the final game of the group?
That's the final game of the group. That's this Thursday, yeah. Next Thursday, yeah. Excuse me.
So then the final game of that group the other final game of that group is that Tunisia Panama matchup, and I think that's going to give some problems from Panama. Even if Panamanian fans and MLS, you know, followers and diehards had kind of circled that one as a chance for Panama to do something, to get a goal, to get a win. Then I think Tunisia in their game against England kind of proved that they're going to be a lot tougher competition than we may have thought. So we'll see how that goes for them. But as far as MLS goes, I actually thought Carlos Vela was really good in the Mexico game. I thought he did a really good job. He had a lot of praise from Juan Carlos Osorio post that game. So that was impressive. I don't know. I look at that Mexican national team and I see a couple future MLS guys. I think Guillermo Ochoa could end up coming to MLS when he's done trying to latch on in Europe. He's still an incredible goalkeeper. He'd probably walk in and be the best goalkeeper, if not the second best goalkeeper in the league. And I have no qualms about that one. And then you have, the left back's name is escaping me, but.
Is that Layún?
Miguel Layún, yes. That's one that the name that's been thrown around in MLS circles before. He had a great game, too, for them, for Mexico. So the MLS El Tri was all very good. Costa Rica, not so very good. And I was really disappointed in the fracas kind of a thing that happened on the sideline in their first game. That kind of, for me, at least looking at them in the way that I didn't like to see that they didn't maybe have their heads about themselves going into that game. That's kind of concerning going forward for them. And in Panama, you know, it was a good fight for 50-plus minutes, and then an amazing freaking goal from Dries Mertens. And then Belgium just showed their class and how much of a level above they are from what Panama has. Kevin De Bruyne's assist was amazing. Romelu Lukaku was a monster up front. In terms of creating space, attacking the space, finding the right space on the runs, And then putting his shots and getting his attacking prowess going in terms of the goal-scoring ability. So an all-around performance from Belgium in the final 40 minutes. You definitely felt like Panama might be able to sneak something there, potentially. But at the same time, it was just, can the dam actually hold for another 40 minutes? And I didn't think it could. So, you know, decent showing from Panama, but, you know, that was about as good as it was going to, I expected it to be against Belgium. So good on them. I think Costa Rica is really my biggest, if you want to go CONCACAF and MLS related team, they're easily my biggest disappointment out of that realm.
Well, that's a good stuff, Dan. I guess one other stat that you didn't throw out that I'll bring up. Japan winning their opener against Colombia, albeit with a red card to Colombia. The first ever win by an Asian continent team against a South American team in World Cup play. So, come on you, Samurai Blue, I guess. I agree with you on a lot of other fronts there, Dan. I don't think there's anything more to say. Let's talk briefly about the trifecta NAFTA World Cup bid winning for 2026. A lot of people have prognosticated on this because it's been just over a week since we pod and this was already out, Dan, but I guess just your general thoughts on 2026. I think the fact that they won it, the fact that Canada gets looped into it, maybe it being a model for future joint World Cup bids, because I think once we get to 48 teams, it's going to be really hard for anybody who hasn't previously, any of the nations that already have the infrastructure that have already hosted a major tournament to host something again like that. But I think it's good for the sport, and now I think there's a lot of work that the people in U.S. soccer circles in U.S. soccer, particularly on the men's senior team and the youth team, have to deal with, and a lot that we have to do from an MLS infrastructure and improvement standpoint in order to be ready and get back to be where I think this nation is capable of being in the next 8 years. Your general thoughts on the bid and what it means for soccer in America?
I'm super happy about the bid. The 2026 World Cup will be the 20-year anniversary of the first World Cup that I ever paid attention to, which is the 2006 World Cup. I'm really happy about them getting the bid and getting all that done. There seems like there's going to be games coming to Kansas City. It's a matter of how many and if we get any knockout round games. But the rumor is that at least two. A reporter for the Kansas City Star said feels that there's about a 75% chance that Kansas City gets at the minimum two games. So that's a pretty strong feeling that Kansas City will at least get something. That's really great for out here. I'm excited for it. And, you know, just overall, it's a great thing for the country to get a chance to host this and kind of bring, you've seen some of like the Swedish invasions and the Icelandic invasions and the Peruvian invasions and stuff all throughout Russia. And you see the mobs of fans in random places, you know, going through city squares and just everybody sitting there and turning their heads as, you know, a giant army of people in bright yellow shirts and Viking horns come marauding down their street. And that's something that's super cool. And I hope I see that, like, going down Power and Light in downtown Kansas City, because that's going to be a heck of a sight in 2026. So it's a good thing that they won the bid. Should have won it for the 2022 World Cup. We're not going to get into that. So, you know, rightfully in the United States' hands to host this one in 2026. It's probably the best place for the expanded World Cup to start out at, considering the infrastructure that we have and everything that, at least on, not just in the United States, but in Mexico and in Canada. The infrastructure here for stadiums is, you know, outside of a significant European nation, is probably second to none. So, you know, this is where you want to go if you want to have the smallest cost, to putting on a World Cup. And I think that's what's going to happen for it. You've got the most places you got a ton of awesome facilities to do it in, ton of great cities, ton of great hosts, for the first, you know, fully expanded World Cup. So that's going to be a whole lot of fun when that hits the shores of North America.
I completely agree with you, Dan. I think it's going to be great for the United States. Mexico will become the first ever nation to host three World Cups together between the two they hosted. I want to say one in the 70s and one in the 80s. So that'll be fantastic. And then you'll have a lot of fantastic venues that'll be returning to the World Cup stage. I did a little bit of a history dig, Dan, and there were 9 different venues that hosted games, albeit in a much smaller variation of the tournament back in 1994. And really only 3 of those stadiums teams are going to be in a similar form to what they are, and only one's going to be really untouched in terms of what it was looking like then, as opposed to what it's going to look like in 2026 based on existing infrastructure needs. And the only one that really hasn't changed, can you guess which one that is, Dan?
No.
It's the Rose Bowl. So, and, you know, with the Rams and the Chargers getting their new stadium, and the Coliseum will be undergoing a renovation for USC football in the next couple of years. Kind of curious to see what happens there. I know the Denver Post and a couple other outlets here in Colorado have been talking about Denver being one of the 23 finalists on the continental U.S. side in it. And it looks like, if the rumblings are believed to be true, sort of they're kind of in a three-way, it's a regional competition, so to speak, and Denver is potentially competing with Rice-Eccles Stadium in Salt Lake City, where the University of Utah football team plays, and then the to-be-built Las Vegas Raiders Stadium in Vegas. I think just because of the size of Rice-Eccles, which is only about 45,000, I gotta think that Mile High would be preferred due to the size of it. Not saying that this should be a region, but I could totally imagine a bunch of internationals coming here and wanting to engage in some substances that are legal in the state of Colorado that are not available in the rest of the United States. And then I think Vegas would be competitive just because if the Raiders Stadium is a dome, then you don't have issues of, you know, playing games in June and July and having it be 120 air degrees outside. And just from everything that we saw with the Stanley Cup Finals being played in Vegas, just like imagine a World Cup, particularly with any Latin or South American team in there. And that just looks like an absolute crazy party that I would totally want to be a part of on a number of different levels. So that's going to be interesting, but I agree it's going to be good for... It's going to be soccer, good for soccer in this country, and I think all the things that 94 were able to do from the United States, it will do as much for Major League Soccer, soccer in America, soccer in Canada, potentially the Canadian Premier League, if and when that starts up. I assume it'll be sometime before the next 4 years. So really curious to see what happens. That said, those of you in positions of power, you officially have your work cut out for you in order to improve that infrastructure, get us better as a soccer nation, as a soccer continent, and get all three of the respective national teams ready to host on, and the federations ready to host. Let's move on, Dan. We didn't touch on this, but we officially had the first sacking of the MLS season, and it was neither out of San Jose, California, nor Commerce City, Colorado. Dan, Jason Kreis is out as the head manager of Orlando City SC, not even a full calendar year with the Lions. Really, really poor run of form. But in my opinion, Dan, I think a lot of this comes down to injuries, the opponents they were playing, playing on the road versus playing at home. And basically, if you look at their schedule, their Dom Dwyer is basically their Diego Chara effect, where if Dom Dwyer's in the lineup, they usually do really well. And when he's not, they do poorly. Your thoughts on this sacking, the timing of it, maybe it being a little bit of a surprise, and particularly the fact that Jason Kreis made, I think, 13 roster changes from last season to this season. The fact that they had him get his hands on the roster, build the team, spend a whole lot of money, and then not let that vision come to fruition. Your general thoughts on that in the decision, and where the heck does Orlando go from here?
I was actually shocked that they... I was shocked, but then I wasn't shocked, because this is, it just tells me that they've been listening to their Twitter base for too long.
Yep.
I actually don't think Jason Kreis was doing a great job, so don't, like, that's where I'm at. Like, don't, I did not think he was doing a good enough job to stick around. However, I still am kind of shocked that that happened now, and they didn't at least wait until Dwyer came back. At least gave it a shot to see maybe, wow, does this team really just rely on Dom Dwyer's production? If that's true, they really don't have another true center forward on the roster. So that's their own dang fault for not, like, building a roster that can sustain Dom Dwyer's absence, because Dom Dwyer has been injury prone the last few years. So, that would just make sense in a roster building move. So if they were to axe him, knowing that just if they felt like it wasn't good enough for him to put a team together that could win despite Dom Dwyer and despite Yoshi Yotun playing in World Cup run-ups and doing all this stuff, and despite Sasha Kljestan being old And having a lot of, him having injury issues and Justin Merrim being used differently and having to adjust to being used differently into a not as successful system, then I get it. But, you know, there's a lot of moving parts to the firing. Like I said, I don't think he was doing a great job with what he had, because it was still Andy Edwards from NBC Sports Network was the guy who's in the press box with us in Kansas City every week, and he did not buy them at all. And his argument was that every single match that they have won has really just been utter chaos, and there's been no like proof that they can sit there and play a calm, reserved match, and they can go out and they can execute a game plan and dominate it. Every single win that they have had over the year was just helter-skelter, coming from behind, trying to get something done. You look back on it, and that's about right. And if that's an indictment on Christ, then fine. But overall, I was a little shocked that Christ was the first one gone. But at the same time, I don't think he was doing the greatest job. Unless Orlando, the rumors, I've seen some interesting rumors that they've been looking at Luis Felipe Scolari to come in as their head coach. No joke, that's the last thing I saw on it. So if that's true and that's the big fish that you're landing to replace Jason Christ, then by all means go do it, because that's clearly a gigantic step forward. However, if you're going to bring in Caleb Porter, I don't think that's a step up. That's probably a lateral step, in my opinion. So unless they've got a big move behind it, I'm still going to kind of question this just a little bit.
I agree with you, Dan. I do think this is a little bit of a appeasing the fan base sort of a thing. I think Christ and his team made a lot of adjustments in the offseason, and I think they were going to kind of take stock in the summer window. Obviously, losing Jonathan Spector, who I think is your only remotely respectable defender, is pretty significant. But, you look at it, it's the numbers are pretty telling that, when the team's healthy and their key players are there and playing well, they win games, and when they're not there, they tend to lose. I agree with your point, or I guess your point via Andy Edwards, saying that, there's not really a whole lot of structure. Christ hasn't really had a good tactical season in terms of his team and roster building and tactics on the field, really since 2013, his last year with RSL. They made it all the way to MLS Cup, lost to Sporting Kansas City. But he didn't really have that. Granted, I don't think he was given a lot of the time, and a lot of pieces were forced on him by ownership at New York City FC. So I don't necessarily want him blame him for that, but he was given the keys to the car, and in a lot of ways, he botched a lot of things or just wasn't able to make it work. Sasha Kljestan's been very inconsistent. Justin Merrim hasn't really fit into this team. I like what I've seen from Yoshi Otun, but whether it's Christian Aguita or whoever, hasn't really been able to fit around him. And I guess I'm kind of wondering at this point of, how much of this was Jason Christ trying to build something and either evolve on his diamond possession, the team is the star approach to the team that he had in Real Salt Lake that he wasn't able to do due to external higher up constraints with New York City FC, but then wasn't really able to build on this. I'm fine with coaches being, a one man or a one system team if you're really, really good at that one system. But I agree with you that there was never really a plan in terms of, evolution of the tactics or the game plan from, Orlando City. It was kind of like a U9's like AYSO game where there's no structure whatsoever. It's just utter chaos. And it just so happens that Orlando had slightly better players or were playing at home that were able to get their winning streak. And it was just as chaotic and just as unsuccessful when they were on the road. All the rumblings based on their roster construction and the players that they have, Dan, is that they're probably looking outside MLS for a non-American. You mentioned the rumor there. I can't remember, somebody suggested that they should give a Guillermo Barros Scalotto a call. I remember a couple months ago there was an article that came out of he's coaching in Argentina currently, folks. And for those of you who aren't longtime MLS people, absolute legend with Columbus Crew SC, that he's coaching in Argentina, and he said if the opportunity came back, he'd love to come to MLS in some capacity. So I think that's something to look at, Dan. But I guess just your thoughts on, I think, them probably going for a foreign coach with tactical ideas. That said, Jason Christ was maybe the one brain they had in the front office who knew how to maneuver the various MLS intricacies that a foreign coach isn't going to know. Are they going to bring in a Brazilian, and his first question going to be, what's a super draft? Dan, if you're talking, I can't hear you.
What they have to do is they have to surround people, surround him. If they're going to bring in someone like a Scolari, then they have to bring in someone, surround him with people who know how to maneuver the MLS setup. So a perfect example would be Atlanta. Tata Martino knew jack squat about MLS and the weird transfer rules and all the mess that is the MLS CBA and the roster rules that go along with that. So that's something that I would do. If I was Orlando, I don't know their full pyramid because I don't really care about them enough to care about their top to bottom pyramid in terms of coaching and technical staff. But whoever they have as a technical director has got to get whoever it is fully up to date. There is that Brazilian connection with Orlando. They've had Marta on the women's side. You had Kaká. You've got they even had Julio Baptista. There's the Brazilian connection and a Brazilian theme with them. I don't think that's a terrible thing, but they just got to make sure that if they're going to bring in someone who doesn't understand the MLS setup, that they surround them with people to help them understand the MLS setup and how to correctly maneuver the wild west that is the MLS roster rules.
I completely agree with you, Dan. I guess let's piggyback this into general MLS coaching talks. Based on the statistics we have from the last couple of years, MLS coaches have had a lot less leash than they've had in, say, the MLS 2.0 and certainly the MLS 1.0 era. I think that's a move in a more positive direction for the league, even if it's less job security for the coaches that are in the league, and that there are expectations and you have to win or at least show progress periodically. We talked about MLS coaching hot seats, so to speak. Your general thoughts on that and maybe where, if any, of the hot seats around the league have changed at all?
Yeah, so I think it's interesting because San Jose, we had this talk, I think you and I both felt and agreed that Colorado and San Jose were the next ones on the list in terms of the firing, that we figured that those were the first ones gone. Even though Ben Olsen, Schmetzer could be on the hot seat, and then certainly Jason Kreis was, although we didn't really rope him in yet. I'm actually going to kind of back off on the San Jose one, just due to some things that I have heard from people who know it. I think he should be on the hot seat 100%. I don't think he is as much as people would like. The Earthquakes, you know, paid a heavy price, have been negotiating with him for months on end to try and get him to come. Jesse Furinelli, they were willing to even pay a transfer fee to the team that he was coaching in Sweden to get him to come and coach the San Jose Earthquakes, because he wanted out of his contract. They didn't want to let him out. They were going to try and take him to court and sue him about it. And then the Earthquakes were trying to say, look, we're offering a transfer fee. We will give you money to buy him out of his contract so he can come coach with us. And it all ended up working out and he ended up coming. So a team that's going to put that much effort into getting someone over, I don't think it's going to give up on them 15, 16, 17 games into their first season, regardless of how bad it is, because the Earthquakes are still a giant project. Same with, I actually might think that Colorado gives Hudson a full season. They gave Mastroianni plenty of years of being absolute crap before. You know, you had a couple of good years and halfway decent years, and then he gets fired last year. So, there's room there, for either of those teams to kind of give their brand new managers leeway. But Kreis had been on that. You think about it, Kreis had been on that job for 2.5 years. They fell pretty pathetically short of the postseason last year. And then to be on the run of bad form that they are with the amount of roster improvement that team had had. It just kind of makes sense why they would want to. It was just something that not a lot of people had on their radar, which is probably why it was surprising. So I think if there's any that we should probably look for more, in the coming weeks, is managers who have been there for a while, that the teams are trending downwards and have been terrible for the last years, those might be the guys on the hot seat. Immediately to mind comes Ben Olsen. I think Jim curtain. If Philly takes a significant turn down in this summer, I wouldn't be surprised if Jim Curtin is on the hot seat for when they get a new person to replace Ernie Stewart. So there's a lot there of moving targets that could be, you know, you're on your hot seat. Petke, I won't say Petke could be one yet, but if RSL, they go through a bad rut in a bad run of form here over the summer, they're also prone to having a Mike Petke potentially being on the hot seat, considering how quickly they've gotten rid of managers in recent years as well. So there's a few names there to look out for, but I think that's probably the more likely scenario now that we're looking at what actually took place with Price, what has been taking place, and what Colorado and San Jose went through to get to their respective coaches. I would think that maybe they would give them just a little bit more leeway. But 2.5 years is by far one of the shortest ropes that the MLS coach has had in years, which is, I don't think it should ever get to the point of Europe where they're firing him after, you know, 10 games because it was bad. But at the same time, I think a little bit of pressure, from the front offices, you know, even with the fact that this league is relatively forgiving, considering 60% of it still makes the postseason, that's a figure that kind of some coaches have skated through on, and for them to be able to, for them to not skate through on it anymore, and get some pressure from front offices to get results and to be up there is a good thing. And I think it's a good step in the direction of the league.
I agree with your assessment on the Colorado Rapids and Anthony Hudson's job security at this point, Dan, based on some of the insider information and a few of the other conversations I've had with people within the organization. Hudson made a really big deal in the most recent of his weekly press conference availabilities that I attended, saying that they were going to have a significant sit down with the front office as far as the plan for the summer transfer window. Based on some of my calculations, they still have a good chunk of general allocation money that they can use and some targeted allocation money they can use. They are into the discretionary TAM budget from everything that I can tell. And Porrick Smith is currently not in Colorado, which means I assume either he's traveling because he needed to be down in Buenos Aires to finalize the details of their friendly with Boca Juniors that'll take place on July 24th that the club just announced this week, or he's potentially scouting a DP. The Rapids still have that open DP saw and a gaping hole where a underneath striker slash dribbly number 10 attacking creator piece could go and fit. So Hudson said that they'll be evaluating everything, looking internally to see how they can improve or maybe adjust some of the player roles that they have, potentially moving some roster players, and then also potentially bringing in some other signings as well. So in that signals to me that the front office and the cronky higher-ups are giving Hudson a little bit more time. They made a lot of drastic changes in this offseason, and they kind of want to see that through to fruition to see whether or not that fruit tree ends up ripening and ends up bearing fruit, so to speak. And I do think now the Rapids are looking at making some other significant changes and potentially trying to make a big splash with that third DP. If they get a Nico Lodero type and make the playoffs, I don't think we're having this conversation in December. If they get another Gabby Torres or, you know, like a Frank Lampard or Steven Gerrard situation, maybe we're having the exact same or an even more intense conversation on that front. I agree with you on Miguel Starre, Dan. I don't know if I've said this on the pod, but I've argued this on so many channels that I'll just say it again. I think the big question for Seattle right now, if their, you know, big seven-figure DP move that they make in the summer ends up not having them turn around their season, at this point, I think the big question is, are they fully engaged in the rebuild? And then it's not so much about, did Smetcher do anything to deserve being fired, so much as do they want to go with that coach or maybe bring up the guy who's at S2 or go for a younger coach who can maybe grow with some of the younger players. I think at this point, especially if they don't make the playoffs at all, even if they come close this season, they're going to need to hit the rebuild. I don't know that Chad Marshall's back with this team. Kim Hee-hee's probably starting. Who knows what version of Roman Torres they're going to get once he's finished with the World Cup. Ozzie Alonso, this is probably his last season. I don't know where Clint Dempsey is and if that contract even makes sense. So I think they got to hit the rebuild reboot after this season. And the question is not so much, did Smetzer do anything during the 2018 season to deserve being fired, so much as, do we want to go with somebody else to, you know, be our Tim Hinkie, hashtag trust the process on that front. I sense that the Galaxy are just praying that the Osanti have such a good season that they're able to move out from under from those contracts or do something in the summer, because they don't have a whole lot of wiggle room. That said, I think Siggy does have this team moving in a positive direction, to where if he goes, then I think someone else has to go in the front office. If you know, somebody from AEG comes in and says, we need to make changes, I don't think Siggy's the only one going, or he's the first one going. I think it'll be Chris Klein or Pete Vianis, and then either Siggy has to go with him, because then they're looking to replace the coach, or they look to replace whoever they fire first, and then that person gets to decide on Siggy's fate, so to speak. I think Remy Gard at Montreal Impact could potentially leave it well, just because Joey Saputo has been a very burn-it-down kind of coach person, but I also think, I think they're waiting for the domino of, can they move Piatti in the summer or not, and then I think decisions will be made after that. But that has to be the first domino that flows. Meanwhile, Ben Olsen's got 10 points from 12 games, and he seems to have complete job security. So none of this makes sense to me, Dan. Dan, I'll give you the last word on the segment, or should we get out of here and head to the roundtable?
On to the roundtable.
No, okay, listeners, we'll be right back. Welcome back, listeners, to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsoccer.com, powered by Last Word on Sports Incorporated, the Beautiful Game Network, and Roughneck Scarves. It is time for the roundtable. I'm joined once again by Dan Sperry. Dan, how pumped are you to talk about the U.S. Open Cup round of 16?
Just as pumped as Peter Vermees was when he crossed an amazing goal the other night. Sporting Kansas City released a behind-the-scenes thing of their goal. At the end of it, you can just see he's sitting there, like, double fist pumping with, like, this, like, wide-eyed, like, I am, like, ravenously hungry and am eyeing, like, my prey type of thing, just staring at the TV in the locker room, just like, oh my gosh, what a goal. So, that's my feeling. I'm talking about the U.S. Open Cup right now.
Johan Indominus Rex Croizet, as far as I'm concerned. Okay, Dan, let's get to it. I feel like we had 8 games in the round of 16, if my math is correct here, folks. Most of them I thought were fairly straightforward in terms of the result that we were expecting, Dan. You had just alluded to it. Sporting Kansas City defeating FC Dallas at home by a score of 3-2. Portland Timbers beating what was effectively LA Galaxy, LA Galaxy B minus, or I guess LA Galaxy 1.5 by a score of 1-0. LAFC getting a 3-2 win in an absolute shootout against Sacramento Republic at home. Houston Dynamo beating Minnesota United and basically their B backline, because they've got a bunch of injuries and Francisco Calvo is obviously in Russia. DC United beating Orlando City after extra time, advancing 4-2 on PKs that I thought was a fairly expected result. The two upsets, at least in my mind, Dan, were Philadelphia Union beating New York Red Bulls by a score of 2-1, and then Chicago Fire on the road in front of a new record crowd for the U.S. Open Cup at Mercedes-Benz, beating Atlanta United by a score of 1-0, and then the last remaining non-MLS team in the tournament, Louisville City Louisville City defeating Louisville City Soccer Club defeating Nashville Soccer Club by a score of 2-1 in Louisville. So they'll be the final, and this is I can't remember how many years, but Cincinnati that made it to the semifinals last year. So Louisville City, the last standing of the non-MLS teams. Dan, your thoughts on all the games that we thought were relatively straightforward and the two crudely cup sets, with Philadelphia Union being New York Red Bulls and Atlanta losing to Chicago Fire. Your thoughts?
The cup set one actually doesn't surprise me. Played well in this tournament. They did a good job of taking care of the Red Bulls. The other one, of course, was Louisville City getting in there is interesting. I've liked what I've seen from Nashville over the season, but Louisville City has just shown why they've been one of the best at USL teams in over the last 2.5, maybe even 3 years. So they're impressive from them to get through. Cup sets were fine. I was mad that LAFC got that late winner against Sac Republic. I thought Republic were doing well and had a chance to pull it off. But, you know, 3-2, Latif Blessing getting the late winner. Just, it's kind of frustrating. Would have hoped you would have gotten a second USL team into the quarterfinals, but didn't shake out that way. So, oh well, here we are. But all I think all the results were not surprising to me, actually, in a way. I, like you said, I mean, they're cup sets because, you know, you would expect in league play, you would expect, you know, Red Bulls to take care of Philadelphia pretty handily. They didn't. You would have expected Atlanta to take care of Chicago pretty handily. They didn't. So, you know, we're now sitting here and like, okay, what do we do with that? It's really disappointing, in my opinion, from Atlanta to go at home and lose in front of a record U.S. Open Cup crowd. 45,000, doesn't matter what kind of crowds you're drawing. If you're losing in knockout games, they've won one or two, I think, U.S. Open Cup matches so far, and then they've lost to Miami FC, who they absolutely should have beaten last year, and then they absolutely should have beaten Chicago Fire last night, and they didn't. So, you know, hold on to your horses, Atlanta, before you start crowning yourselves the kings of soccer America. You've got to win trophies to do that, so show up when it's time to actually win trophies. Overall, you know, there's a lot of good games in it, too. The Sporting KC FC Dallas game that I was at was absolutely insane. The game-winning goal from Johan Kraaze had everybody in the press box's jaw dropped. Everyone was in shock after that hit. You know, Daniel Shallow, he scored a very, very good goal to put Sporting KC up 2-1. The Dallas did well to kind of muck it up and get their goals. Both of them came against the run of play, and both were kind of just mental lapses in the back line for Sporting Kansas City, which featured one player playing at left back who is 17 years old, and Emiliano Amor making his third appearance of the season. It was actually impressive in large parts and gets very far forward, but can play really, really good line-splitting passes, and he's really, really, really good. If he wasn't sitting behind Matt Beisler and Aiko Parra, he probably would be starting on, I'd say, 15 of the 23 MLS or 20, wherever we're at on numbers. But he'd be starting in about 15 MLS teams right now at center back. So an incredible, very, very good player. You know, kind of some, so a little bit of out of whack on the back line. Tim Willia wasn't there. Sporting Kansas City got the job done, though, thanks to an absolute golazo from Johan Kraaze. I don't think we'll see a better goal than that in the entire tournament to take it the way he did. The ball was up high. Vermees roughly compared it to Zidane's goal just in terms of how high up the ball was before he hit it on the full volley, and to take it down and to rip it like that into the upper corner. You know, it wasn't one of those looping things. It was just a complete laser into the side netting. He even curled it into the left. Like, he's facing the near post, and he's pretty much level in terms of width of the field with the near post, and still got that ball to curl into the side netting of the upper corner at that near post. It was an absolutely incredible strike. So, heck of a game, heck of a weekend. But I don't know. What were your thoughts on what transpired in the U.S. Open Cup?
I thought it was fairly straightforward, but still very exciting, Dan. You know, it was kind of nice that at least, you know, normally if there wasn't a World Cup, so to speak, you know, most of the MLS teams would have had a midweek game. So then we would have kind of seen, you know, B teams or different teams kind of taking it seriously. Having a nice little break in there, I think, gave the opportunity for a lot of teams to field the best roster that they had, sans some of their, their players gone for the World Cup. Obviously, no Carlos Vela, really, really hurt LAFC. You know, Minnesota had a couple players missing. So that was a little bit disappointing in terms of just the quality of play, but overall I still think that's a net positive to say if you want a better Open Cup competition in a World Cup year, would it be better to have some players missing due to the World Cup or have MLS teams be having to juggle and make decisions regarding which games to take seriously and then maybe resting some key guys for, you know, two weekend MLS games with an Open Cup match, say, on the road with a lot of travel in between. So that was really, really nice. That said, I thought the most of the results were pretty straightforward. You know, I in hindsight, maybe the I kind of picked it because just I thought that Jesse Marsh was going to have everybody ready regardless of how much of a B squad the Red Bulls were putting against Philly. But, you know, say what we've said, you know, last segment about Jim Kirchen, he tends to get the Union up for these sorts of games, so that doesn't necessarily disappoint me, but I agree with you on the disappointment with what happened to Atlanta. I go back with a little bit of banter with a friend from college who discovered MLS right as Atlanta was coming into existence, and she and her husband are now Atlanta United fans, so we were talking, and I'm kind of their main soccer person to go to with big questions about, like, tactics or formation or, like, how does a transfer fee work or something like that. And typically they'll ask me, you know, when the Ezequiel Barco rumor came out, it's like, what do you know about this guy? I'm like, I've never heard of him. He's some teenager that plays in Argentina, but let me look up and see what I can find. And one thing that I always have to temper them with, Dan, albeit, you know, sitting here with, you know, the two teams I cover having one MLS Cup, is chill. You guys are a great expansion team. I'm happy to have you in a league. Don't declare yourself a super team until you've actually won a cup, so to speak, or some form of trophy on that front. But Dan, let's move on to the quarterfinals. Listeners, these will all take place on July 18th, so not quite a calendar month from now. Philadelphia Union will host Orlando City at Talon Energy Stadium. Chicago Fire will host Louisville City. Houston Dynamo will host Sporting Kansas City in what used to be a big rivalry, Dan. Tell me whether or not you think so. And then I think the cream of the crop as far as competitive matchups and location, LAFC hosting the Portland Timbers. Dan, your thoughts on the quarterfinals and who you think we could see go into the semis?
Quarterfinals are interesting. I think that's if they can win this game, I would like to believe that they are going to end up they have a great shot to go win it again, because this is about as hard as it gets for one of their remaining matches. They're going to be sandwiched in between weekend match days, and they will have to travel to Houston, play in the heat at a midweek. Question is, you know, they won't, I don't know how close to fully healthy they will be, but right now they are not close to being fully healthy. They finally had, you know, three of their injured guys, out of their recent injuries and their non-significant injuries. They've had three of them, all three have returned to practice this week. They still have three that are long-term, potentially the end of, late end of June, mid-July, returns. So, and then you have, you know, Felipe Gutierrez, who's been out for since the fifth game of the year. That's going to be a rough one for them, but if they win that one, that's a great shot for them to get in, to the final, because, you know, I think LAFC is kind of interesting on that end. Also you have Portland Timbers, both teams that I think Sporting Kansas City could well handle in the semifinal. That's going to be an interesting matchup though between LAFC and Portland. I really like that game. That's going to be pretty high pressure and intensity, and hopefully both teams will be there to play their full squads. But it looks like the 18th is going to be pretty much sandwiched in between match days for all MLS teams in this, so that's going to be really frustrating for them. Louisville City, who did Louisville City play again? I've forgotten. I haven't.
They defeated Nashville. They play the Chicago Fire. It will be at Toyota Park in Chicago.
And I think that's probably one of the best. I mean, that's, in my opinion, that's the best draw that they could have gotten out of it. I mean, they could have gotten Philly, but Philly, like I said, Philly tends to do well in this tournament. They don't take anyone lightly. They don't really take kindly to cup sets. They go and get their crap done. So this is probably one of the best draws for Nashville if they want to get into the semifinal. I believe Cincinnati had to go through Chicago Fire to get to their semifinal bid. I believe that was the next stop after the Columbus Crew match. So if we're going to get a USL team into the semifinals again, I think Louisville City have a pretty good road for it. But interesting to look at who's left in the East versus who's left in the West. This one kind of, I would assume, we'll see what actually happens, but I would assume, that whoever comes out of the Western side should be favored, to win this tournament. You've got four very, very strong teams, in the final side and four relatively question mark teams, on the Eastern side coming up for this tournament.
For me, this is a tale of two, I guess, two conferences or two regions here, Dan, but in a slightly different way. You know, I look into the two Western regions, the Midwest and the Western region. You've got Houston Dynamo hosting Sporting Kansas City, LAFC hosting Portland. Those are four teams that definitely in a month from now are still going to be in the playoffs and are going to have other big priorities to have. Obviously, as we've talked on and off on this show, Chicago Fire looking to spend some money, but who knows if it gets done by then or where they are in the standings. I could say the same thing for the Philadelphia Union, as that'll be what the final 2 weeks of the Ernie Stewart era in Chester, Pennsylvania. And then who knows where Orlando City is with their new head coach, whether or not he even cares about a cup that he's never even heard of, as opposed to trying to get the team in the playoffs, assuming he's even heard of playoffs. And then obviously Louisville City is going to be prioritizing Open Cup. We saw how much momentum it gave FC Cincinnati to put them on the soccer map, so to speak. And if they were to somehow able to defeat the Fire, win the semifinal, and win the tournament, like in the middle of like February in like Kentucky winter, having Club America have to go play at Slugger Field, I just think would be such a spectacularly weird experience that I'd want to see happen in some alternate universe. So you've got four teams in the West that are all very good quality, all have depth, but all maybe have something else on their mind come July 18th. And then on the other side, I think you've got three MLS teams that realistically could be trying to prioritize that, not knowing where their status is in the summer transfer window due to changes that are going on in their front office or their rosters, and then also potentially not being in a position to make the playoffs, to where you think you win this game, you're two games away from winning a trophy, regardless of whether or not you crash out of trying to make the playoffs. So that's kind of interesting for me, just because you've got two conferences, you've got two ends of the bracket with all four teams, I think, that are going to be in very different states, and that's just going to be really interesting to see how they all handle that. Let's move on, Dan, to the rapid fire content. We're going to start. You've got some news out of the Quakes, Dan, that apparently like Quakes Twitter is actually excited about, and that's new for Quakes Twitter.
Yeah, Quakes Twitter has been all in their feet the last month and a half, a whole freaking, I don't know. It's been, Quakes Twitter has been a head case lately. But both, I think most of Quakes Twitter and the Earthquakes themselves are very excited at the arrival of Garam Kashia to the San Jose Earthquakes. I'll make it quick, a couple of points on him. One, he was the captain of the Georgian national team and best friend to current Quakes designated player Vako Kwasiashvili. This is a player who is also regarded as one of the best defenders in the Eredivisie, comes from a very strong club in Vitesse. This is a player that, as a center back, is a vocal leader. He's very animated. He's got a lot of passion, a lot of energy to him. He's 30 years old, yes, but, you know, defenders can still stick around for a little while. This is overall a move that the Earthquakes absolutely needed to do. They needed some type of center back help because their loan signing of Jefferson Quintana doesn't look all that great. So that's one that's hard there. Then you have, Harold Cummings, who I constantly call Omar Cummings because I've been around MLS way too long. And then after that, it's pretty much a big question mark. Francois Afritou hasn't been great, and they've been relying on Jimmy Ockford, who's just a year removed from playing in MLS, to probably be the second best center back for them. So Agaram Kashia and Harold Cummings, center back duo, I think will actually be very, very nice for the Earthquakes. I said this is a guy who's very well regarded by their fans, similar to when Johnny Russell, it was announced that Johnny Russell was coming to Sporting Kansas City. All the Derby County fans came and, like, you know, were talking to Sporting Kansas City fans. They talked him up, just tons and tons of, oh, we're going to miss you, well wishes, all this stuff. Really loved the guy. Same thing from Garam Kashia coming over from Vitesse. The Vitesse fans are, upset, not upset that he's leaving, but sad that he's leaving and feel like it's going to be a very big miss for their team in the future. So, to have a guy that has one international team captaincy, acclaim to him, as well as, good acclaim in a very strong European league, coming to the Earthquakes to help their back line is a very big positive, something that should really help out the Quakes. Nobody is ever out of it in this league, and the Earthquakes have been scoring a whole lot of goals in past years. They're on pace to surpass 50 goals for the first time probably since like 2012. So that, you know, this is a team that has had a lot of struggle scoring goals. They're doing well on the goal scoring front. The defensive issues are just, glaring for them. And if they can kind of shore up the defensive side, you know, that could bode well for them going forward. It's definitely a great move, but it's not their only move. They still have a couple more lined up, in the summer transfer window that they're looking to come in, but this was one that is, he'll be ready to actually join the team, on July 10th when the summer transfer window opens.
Moving on, Dan, there's a rumor that Club America of Liga MX is interested in Joseph Martinez, striker for Atlanta United, who just set the record for hat tricks in MLS play. Tata Martino had a couple comments on that this week, saying that Atlanta doesn't really, that, you know, the interest officially from Club America is real, but they haven't really expressed the extent to which that's significant. Are they kind of interested in Joseph Martinez? Is he their main target for the summer transfer window? That is really unclear, according to Martino, from the Atlanta United to Club America communications, so to speak. He also said that, you know, Atlanta has plenty of cash. They're, you know, they're not like maybe one of the budget teams in MLS, where if you have a chance to make a couple million dollars profit on one of your younger end DPs, if that's something that you automatically have to do in order to reinvest in the club or do something else as far as the ownership is concerned. So they don't really need the money. They're a club that's trying, that is aspiring to win trophies, as I mentioned, you know, a couple of minutes ago. That said, according to one of the newspapers in Mexico City, they were saying that there was a potentially a price tag as high as $40 million that Club America is willing to pay for Joseph Martinez. And just my mind explodes when I hear that, Dan, because, you know, in my mind, MLS is now starting to realize that it needs to sell before it becomes a massive buying league. And I can't think of a single player in MLS, including David Villa, Sebastian Giovinco, or any other player anywhere in the league, if you were offered $40 million for them, you wouldn't immediately sign on the dotted line. Just like, you're telling me that you can't, like, that's 2 2/3 Ezequiel Barcos, and you're telling me Atlanta can't reinvest that in the team and make it just as good as with Joseph Martinez. So, a little bit wishy-washy in terms of where the communications are, how willing Atlanta are to part with him, as opposed to maybe seeing, can they win something this summer, or this winter, this fall, in a supporter shield potentially, and in an MLS Cup potentially, and then maybe sell Joseph Martinez in the winter transfer window when his stock's maybe a little bit higher. But regardless, the fact that there's a notion that potentially $40 million are being spent on a forward from MLS, I think is tremendous. We'll see whether or not this happens. I think eventually they're going to have to move on from him, because obviously the Joseph Martinez's, the Miguel Amarones, the Hector Villalba's, and Ezequiel Barcos do have aspirations to go elsewhere. And at some point, everybody has a price tag, but if you get a chance to, you know, double your money on something and then bring in another young player who can fit that, I think you have to. I just don't know that the timing's right now for Atlanta on their front. Who knows where Joseph Martinez's head is at. Moving on, Dan, the MLS All-Star Game is coming. Juventus is coming to MLS. I've completely forgotten about this because of the World Cup. The jerseys came out and they look like really, really boring, with like a five-year-old coloring in with some colored markers on the shoulders. Your thoughts on the jerseys, and should we even care about the All-Star Game given how much else is going on this summer in the soccer world?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting. I'm excited. I'm more annoyed at the voting and the fact that all Atlanta players up top have sprinkled in a couple of other random players. Come on. I think one of the best tweets I've seen about the All-Star voting was from Aiko Parra, who quote tweeted the All-Star vote numbers and said, there's Atlanta United's tweet about like, oh, hey, look here, look at all the players who are at the top of the voting thing, and he tweeted them and asked if they had the Russians working for them. So that was a great zing from Aiko Parra, who is easily one of the best followers on Twitter. He doesn't tweet a lot, but when he does, it's absolute gold. So Aiko Parra is my guy. That was a great one. I don't know. I don't really care. The MLS All-Star Game has turned to, since they decided to do the voting, the fan voting 11, and you've got managers and coaches that are trying to please everyone, picks and do all kinds of stuff. I don't care. It's a little too political, a little too much of a showy, dumb event at this point. I think it's kind of dumb. I like it for I like it when it's interleague. I think those all-star games are fine. Those are fun. I am getting to a point where it's cool that we're playing European opposition, but I could care less about what team that we put out to do it, because in the end, this game really doesn't matter. It'd be a lot more fun for me, I think, now if we did something like this with both East and West. I think the league is at a star level standpoint where you could do it and it could still be a pretty big draw. But you know what? Hey, I'm not going to tell them how to make their money. So if they want to continue to do this, then continue to do this. But you know, it'll be exciting to see Juventus because I feel like they're one of the European teams that doesn't come over a whole lot. The last time I remember Juventus coming to the States, they did the International Champions Cup thing. And they played at AT&T Park against Everton, and it was a shootout. And ended up going to a penalty kick shootout. Gigi Buffon actually lost to Tim Howard in that one, so it's kind of interesting. Weird match, but that as far as my recollection goes, that's the last time I remember Juventus being on American soil for a preseason tour, so it is cool that they're coming over. We get to see them in a high, at least a high-profile setting, but you know, I don't know. I'm kind of past the All-Star game.
I'm with you there, Dan. You know, it's going to be interesting to see. It's a fun little event, but at the same time, you know, I take it with so many grains of salt, given where the opponent is going to be at and where the MLS All-Star squad is going to be at. You mentioned potentially going to Interleague, so maybe a West versus East competition. I've kind of always been on the MLS All-Stars versus like a Liga MX Best 11. I think that would be a really fun alternative to the current format, but you know, we'll see. I'll definitely watch it. I filled out my fan vote and I tweeted that out last night because I think the voting as of today, June 21st, is officially closed. So, I mean, we'll see where it goes. I guess to Atlanta United fans who really, really wanted to see all of your Atlanta players at Mercedes-Benz Arena, lest I remind you that Greg Garza, who just re-injured, who just got hurt, that injury started back at the All-Star game last year at Soldier Field in Chicago. So having all of your players on that field, you know, potentially getting another injury, I say, you know, you know, don't be Icarus flying so close to the sun, so to speak. I guess I'm just an Atlanta United hater right now, Dan. But moving on. English midfielder Jack Rodwell supposedly is looking for a move to Major League Soccer. For those of you not familiar with him, he was most recently mostly a holding midfielder, kind of like a number six, number eight-ish hybrid with Sunderland AFC. Sunderland not in the greatest position right now, Dan, given that they just suffered back-to-back relegations and they're technically now in League One. But all reports out of there is the Black Cats front office has allowed him to get out of his contract. So he's effectively a free agent and is interested in coming to MLS, given his position and maybe his age and a few other things, Dan. He's 27. I'm not sure this is a DP. I think this is a solid, maybe, you know, like a TAM level version of what you would get out of, say, not really, maybe a Roger Espinosa. I'll admit I don't watch him a whole lot, but you know what? I'd say a number six in MLS and then a TAM international version of that. I'm not entirely sure who would be interested in him at this point, but I guess it's kind of interesting. We'll see if anything moves. He says that he's interested in it, but we haven't really heard any rumblings on the MLS side of the league is potentially interested in him. A particular team is interested in him. I'll admit I haven't watched a whole lot of Sunderland for good reason, to where I have an understanding of, say, maybe a team that he would fit in really well with. Moving on, Dan, our final rapid fire topic. Why don't you tell us what ESPN's Jeff Carlisle was reporting about this hilarious, potentially unprofessional thing that Meyer Geiger supposedly did in the Portugal-Morocco game earlier this week.
Yeah, so apparently one of the Morocco players post-game questioned the integrity of in their match between Portugal and Morocco. That match official was none other than Mark Geiger. And Geiger, according to this Moroccan player, was told by Pepe, which already has me questioning things on that, that Geiger had asked for Ronaldo's jersey after the game. For me, I don't know. I laughed at that. Understanding Mark Geiger, I wouldn't be shocked if he like made like a joking, smirking comment to him about like, hey, can I get your jersey after the game? Okay, move on, let's go. Because it is Cristiano freaking Ronaldo, so when does he ever have a chance to referee his games unless it's something like this? So that was a kind of a funny thing that happened there, but I mean, consider the source that it came from Pepe to this Moroccan player, that's another very big question mark. I think I was joking with you off air, or at least while we were, before we were recording, that, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if Pepe was just trying to play mind games with them and get, like, Morocco riled up that the ref was against them to just kind of destroy their mental state of mind to get into it. Pepe seems like the ultimate, like, godfather, sonning, I'm going to make some crazy move to get in your head, win at all cost person. So I don't know about that, but FIFA did release a statement. I'll see if I can pull it up, because I just tweeted something about it. Simultaneous podcaster and tweeter. Oh, here is the FIFA statement. It says, it is with regret and disappointment that following yesterday's Group B game between Portugal and Morocco, FIFA has learned of reports in the media concerning the referee Mark Geiger. It has been claimed that Mr. Geiger asked for the certificate captain of Portugal, and even name Ronaldo, during the halftime interval. Mr. Geiger strongly reviews these claims and categorically states that such a request was not made. FIFA unequivocally condemns the allegations supposedly made by a member of a Moroccan team. FIFA referees are under clear instructions with regard to their behavior and relationship with the team to 2018 FIFA World Cup Russia, and it can be confirmed that Mr. Geiger has acted in an exemplary and professional manner as an appointed match official. FIFA would like to remind teams of their duty to respect all principles of fair play. I assume there's some type of thing of, like, not questioning the official's match integrity, and saying things like that in the media post-game. But whatever it was, it's still really hilarious that this whole thing kind of shook out the way it did.
Yeah, I think this is hilarious as well. There's two lenses to which I view this, Dan. First of all, if it did happen, you know, Mark Geiger, who's been much riled by MLS and by American soccer fans, you know, this might be peak Mark Geiger in terms of his just level of wackiness and weird things that he does, because he is a little bit of a goofy personality, independent of being a head official. So on one end, potentially highly unprofessional, controversial, clearly indicating a lack of objectivity or borderline fanboying that I do not think belongs in belongs in professional soccer officiating at a World Cup in a first division league like MLS or anywhere else. On the other side, just the fact that this could just be Pepe totally making stuff up, peak CONCACAFing, and absolutely hilarious. I hate you, Pepe, but kind of keep doing it because it's kind of entertaining in a sick way. Moving on, Dan, let's go to weekend pickums. We will start this Saturday. All MLS games. We have two games on Sunday, folks. No Friday games, unfortunately. All their games are on Saturday. We'll begin on Saturday, Dan, at 6 p.m. Eastern on Unimas. New York Red Bulls hosting FC Dallas. Who you got and why?
Hold on. Since we do have breaking news here, this is why I searched Twitter. Orlando City has also signed Irish-American center back Shane O'Neill on a full transfer from Brighton and Albion. That was something that came across them. Apparently we missed on that. So a quick interesting thing on that. I think it's interesting that they went out and got a center back right after Jason Christ is gone. I don't know who made the move and pulled the trigger, but clearly it wasn't Jason Christ. So interesting move there. It literally just popped up on my feed before you asked him that question. Do you have any thoughts, or do you want to move on to it?
I mean, he was okay when he was with the Colorado Rapids, from what I remember. I'll admit I don't watch a whole lot of Eredivisie, so I don't know where he's at. That said, the Orlando City has gaping holes at center back that they need to fill, and Shane O'Neill has proven that he can be a competent center back in Major League Soccer. So we'll see whether or not it works out. I echo your points of, if Jason Christ just got fired, who's making this move, and how do you know the new head coach, who's potentially not even been contacted by the club yet, is going to like him as a player? But moving on, Dan, New York Red Bulls hosting FC Dallas. Who you got and why?
I'm going to go with New York Red Bull and FC Dallas, but this is going to be a really interesting matchup, because if FC Dallas do what they do best, which is not allow teams that have a set way of doing things, like a Sporting Kansas City, like New York Red Bulls, they have a very set playing style and a set tactical setup that they do with very small tweaks based on the opponent. FC Dallas is a team that likes to go in and say, haha, we're not going to allow you to do what you want to do. They play the gamesmanship card. They time waste. I think they got, in the US Open Cup match, they got 3 yellow cards for time wasting. And all of them within the first half, when it was 1-1. So, you know, these are all just like really doing this already. Those types of things are the FC Dallas, like, attempt to get under your skin and get in your head and frustrate you and boil you over the top. I don't know if the New York Red Bulls will be up for it or not. I would hope they would be, considering they're at home. I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt on that. FC Dallas have been really good, but I really like New York Red Bulls this year. So I'm going to say 2-1 to the host, New York Red Bulls.
3-3 because Major League Soccer. Moving on, Sporting Kansas City hosting the Houston Dynamo at 8:30 p.m. Eastern. Dan, who you got and why? And since these teams both moved to the Western Conference, is this still like a rivalry derby in the same way that, you know, these teams were going at it? It felt like every single Eastern Conference final in like the 2011 to 2013 era.
Yeah, I think it's not as heated because a lot of the players on the Houston side of that rivalry are not there. Which sounds like Sporting Kansas City super old, but they just had a lot of good players that were in their prime that are now just kind of towards the very end of their prime, their careers. Sporting Kansas City still has a lot of very different figures in that, but the main culprits for Houston Dynamo, I think within those years, they're all pretty much gone. I don't know if the rivalry is there as much as the RSL one is, and even then the RSL one is somewhat waning, and it probably won't finally go once Kyle Beckerman goes away. I'd say the Minnesota game is one that's if there's any like real rivalry for Sporting Kansas City, the Minnesota one's kind of picked up a little bit. But FC Dallas has probably been the most intense on-field rivalry for them in the last couple of years, and that just has to do with success for both teams on the field. So this one's going to be interesting. I'm actually going with the barn burner this one. I'm going to say 4-2 to Sporting Kansas City. Houston Dynamo's backline is old and slow, and they get shredded apart when they're not at home. But at the same time, Houston Dynamo have Albert Elise, Romel Kyoto, Mario Minotas, very, very pacey guys on the counterattack. And if Sporting Kansas City kind of had a hard time holding them in check, even though towards the end of the season with the two games that they played and then the final game and then the playoff game against each other, it ended up being like, I think it was like 3-1 over those three games, including a 0-0 draw and a 1-0 extra time, win for Houston. It was still those wingers caused a whole lot of trouble, for Sporting Kansas City. In the back, I don't know if Seth Sinovic is healthy. But either way, it's either going to be Beck or Seth Sinovic, and I think that could potentially pose some pace problems and some experience problems if it's Jalen Lindsey against somebody like an Albert Elise. So it'll be interesting to see how Sporting Kansas City take that. They're very aware of what Houston has in the counterattack, but that is going to be a heck of a matchup that you should be watching on Saturday night. That's going to be really fast-paced. I think there's going to be a lot of goals in it, so I'm going to say 4-2 to Sporting KC.
Retweet favorite. Moving on to Sunday, this will be on Fox, Big Fox, folks, Bart Simpson Fox, as Rob Stone would like to say. Atlanta United FC hosting the Portland Timbers. This will be at 4:30 p.m. Eastern. Dan, who you got at Mercedes-Benz Arena?
I'm going to go with Atlanta at Mercedes-Benz. I would like to place a prop bet on a Diego Chara crunching tackle, Darlington Nagbe, just for funsies. I'm going to go with Atlanta in this one. Portland has been playing really well lately, but they've kind of slowed down. I won't say they've slowed down to a halt, but they've at least slowed down in terms of the train running forward that was just win after win after win after win. They're still not fully, I don't believe they're fully healthy. I don't believe they're fully, have everyone, including from the World Cup back. They won't. So that is going to be some problems. Noah Andy Polo, who's been really good for them, and I believe no David Guzman, if I'm correct as well. So they've got a couple of holes here and there for them right now. We'll see. But Atlanta at home after a disappointing midweek result, I would expect it's the result.
I'm going to say 2-1 to Atlanta United here, Dan. I agree with you on everything you said. Portland missing a couple guys because of the World Cup, having a couple injuries, having to travel all the way across the country. They'll be familiar with turf, obviously, since they've got turf at Jeldwin Field or whatever, Providence Park now it's called, excuse me. But, you know, I think Atlanta's going to be a little bit better. I think Atlanta has to improve on what they did against Chicago. I'm going to call for a set-piece orgy in the spirit of what's been the World Cup so far. I think Atlanta hits a couple bangers and then probably goes up 2-0. I think Diego Valeri will probably do something from a nice short-range distance just outside the box, but it won't be enough. Atlanta United wins 2-1. That does it for us, folks. Dan, time for last words. Where can people find you on the Twitter machine? Do you have any last words?
You can find me on Twitter, @Sparadino94. And last words, I have none other than go enjoy the World Cup this weekend. Enjoy some of the great matchups, and enjoy the final match of Liverpool. I won't be around next week. I'll be on vacation, so I probably won't be able to talk until the knockout round or around the knockout round. So enjoy the rest of the World Cup group stage. We will sadly see you go Peru, Nigeria, and some of the other teams that have played well but just haven't gotten results. We'll see if Argentina picks it up too, but enjoy the World Cup as it comes. And of course, thanks for listening.
Good night, sweet prince. I'm also have a World Cup last word here, Dan. VAR has been involved, I believe, in 7 total decisions, and I think VAR is comfortably 7-for-7. The communication and the indication from the officiating crew that a review is under being taken in the mystical VAR box that I assume is somewhere in the middle of the Kremlin, probably. That communication has been very clear. What they are reviewing and what the ultimate decision was and how that's been communicated has been very, very good. So, you know, I guess, MLS VAR, you've been doing it for a calendar year now. Take a look at how it's being used in the World Cup and see how you can improve it. But for, I think, all the concerns we had that it wasn't going to get anything right, I thought the calls have been very clear cut. They've made a lot of really, really good decisions, and they haven't had a whole lot of controversies on the officiating. The officiating's been very good, and the implementation of VAR as well as the communication of VAR has been very good. That's really, really positive. I wish Major League Soccer could up their game to that level. Listeners, you can follow me on Twitter @LWSMattPollard. Check out all of our written audio and video work at lastwordonsoccer.com. Thank you to our sponsors, Roughneck Scarves, the official scarf supplier of Major League Soccer, the USL, US Soccer, and now all of the other national teams that are playing in the World Cup. Get your custom scarves for your group, your team, or just yourself at roughneckscarves.com. Follow us on Twitter @LastWordSC, and across all social media platforms. Check out our written work at lastwordonsoccer.com. Subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for LWS Radio. Am I missing anything here, Dan?
I see nothing missed.
Okay, then thank you very much for listening, folks. We'll see you next week, possibly without Dan, or maybe in 2 weeks once we're into the knockout stages of the World Cup. We'll see you then.